Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. On this episode of Wandering DMs, by viewer demand, Paul, we're doing part two of our original Dungeons & Dragons versus Moldvay basic Dungeons & Dragons for another week, because we just scratched the surface last time. And, of course, it's the 50th anniversary of D&D, and these are two of our favorite editions that we're constantly thinking about the benefits of, so we're going to continue that conversation today. Which, again, we're going to answer the question, which one is better and why?
Which one is better is clearly we came to a decisive stance on that last week.
Paul, since then, it was 2 weeks ago, Paul. I'm going to correct several things that are mistaken already. Now. And one is our last episode was 2 weeks ago. We're off last week. And Paul, I hate to say it, I've reevaluated my assessment. So now my opinion at the end of the day might be different.
All right. Viewers, I'll just take a moment now to remind you that before we get into it, that at the end of the hour, we will be progressing into our after party chat, where we will continue the debate and probably still come up with no conclusions. That is going to happen today at a little after 2 p.m. Eastern time. It's a private video chat hosted by Dan and I with our patrons. So you can join in on that if you'd like. Come and join the conversation with us and other patrons of the site by visiting patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server, which is where we host the after chat. And we look forward to seeing you there.
Very much so. Big shout out to Bacquius for checking our connections, as always. That's super helpful. Thank you so much. And also, shout out, Gen Con was this weekend, and they were celebrating 50 years of Dungeons & Dragons. So hello to everybody who made the trip out to Indy for Gen Con, and are wrapping up this Sunday afternoon, if you're joining us live. Lovely to have you as we also join the celebrations of 50 years of D&D and 43 years of Moldvay Basic D&D.
Maybe you're listening to this as an audio podcast as you drive home from Gen Con and the long ride back to wherever it is you're coming from. So welcome. Welcome to the debate.
Definitely. Hope you have a
good
weekend.
Good chance that there's going to be a part three, right? That's something Dan and I were just discussing before we went live here. It's like, there's a lot of stuff for us to talk about here. So, but Dan, where would you like to start today?
Well, I think, you know, so the first episode, if we go back 2 weeks, we were mostly talking about character generation issues, like the differences in multi-classing in particular, and how Moldvay invented this idea of races class to simplify things in the basic game. And we easily filled up a whole hour-long discussion and didn't even completely finish that, because right at the end of it, we just started to talk about the issue of what we now call sweep attacks. And I actually feel, which is a fighter feature in later editions of D&D, and I actually feel that mechanically, that's one of the single biggest differences between the two games, between the original or AD&D line and the basic line, is do fighters get a flurry of attacks against low-level creatures? And that's clearly baked into the expectations for original D&D. And that was removed for basic. And I actually now think if I had to pick one single difference between the two games, that's actually the biggest for me.
Dan, I'd like to broaden that discussion a little bit and talk about all forms of multiple attacks, of which there are many. There are many different ways, as I've scoured through the books, that a player can have multiple attacks, whether you're talking about fighter level progression or rate of fire for missile weapons. Or, right. You know, your new personal favorite, the sweep attack.
Sweep the leg.
Very controversial form of attack, as we were well trained in Karate Kid.
I think I've been backstabbed.
So, you know, I have here next to my desk on different sides of, me piles of books. I have OD&D and basic BX D&D, and I have first edition AD&D, and I have second edition AD&D, because honestly, I was having trouble finding some things. And I would say, when I look at AD&D, first edition to second edition, I would say that the changes are not huge, and that generally, for me, finding things in second edition is a little bit easier than first edition. Some of these rules in first edition, heck, in OD&D, in BX, they're hard to find. They're buried in the text in weird places. I'm not always sure where to look for them. So, so I've got all these different editions out, and I'm happy to dig through them.
Well, I think you're in good company, Paul. I was certainly making notes this morning. One of our viewers at the moment, Lore Sudo in the chat, hey Lore Sudo, is asking right now, were sweep attacks even in AD&D? Because I never came across them.
Yeah.
Now, Paul, you and I were trying to find this 10 minutes ago, right before, immediately before this episode started, Lore Sudo. That is exactly the thing that Paul and I were trying to find in the books. I'm a little bit more familiar with AD&D, and so I was able to point out that in the player's handbook, at the end of the fighter class, specifically page 25, does not use the term sweep attack.
Nope.
It's this footnote that Paul's pointing at right there.
Yeah. I was telling Dan, I was kind of laughing, frankly, because I was, as I mentioned, because I couldn't find it in first edition at all. I cracked open my second edition AD&D book here and was noticing in the fighter section, there is a chart for warrior melee attacks per round. And I was like, that's hilarious that you've got a whole rule here that isn't really mentioned in the text, but is just, oh, there's a chart, yep. So that's good enough, right? You just chuck a chart in there, and that's good enough to find rules. And apparently that's an improvement from first edition AD&D, because in first edition AD&D, we have a rule here that is a footnote to a chart. It's the same chart. It's the same chart of fighters, paladins, and rangers attacks per melee round. But it just has a little footnote here, and I'll just read it out for our viewers because I found this exciting. It says, there's a attacks per melee round has an asterisk, and the asterisk note says, this excludes melee combat with monsters, QV, of less than one hit die, D8, and non-exceptional, zero level, humans and semi-humans, i.e., all creatures with less than one eight-sided hit die. All of these creatures entitle a fighter to attack once for each of his or her experience levels. See combat. So I just love making fun of this footnote, right? Because there's all these parentheticals, multiple reiteration of how a hit die is D8, a final note about seeing combat, which is a lie. There is nothing in the combat section about this. But there you go.
It is one of those places where there's like a really important rule hidden in the footnote to a table. There's a number of places in AD&D and other editions where I have to like document or highlight in my book, like this footnote really changes the game, and it really buries the lead, right? The point of the footnote doesn't, they don't deliver the point of the footnote until the very last line. The lead should be, you get an enormous number of attacks in this special situation, right? Whatever your level is, you get that many attacks, and here's the special situation when it happens.
Yeah.
You can, like, I think there's a, like, some days I might not have the patience to get through all that language to get what the hell the point is at the end of that paragraph.
It's very well hidden. That's a very well hidden rule. Now, but maybe not as well hidden as the rule in OD&D. Because I got out my copy of OD&D and I'm flipping through the books and I'm wondering, like, where does it tell me how many attacks anyone gets? Where is combat described in OD&D, Dan? which volume, one, two, or three of OD&D describes combat?
Sort of. Maybe you need to pick up chainmail.
Yeah.
That'll be in the supplement. I'll be in the supplement later on.
Completely hand waves all of combat and just says, see chainmail.
Yeah.
Which I don't even have a physical copy of here, Dan, so I'm screwed.
It does.
I'm gonna rely on you. It's on you because I don't even have the text in front of me. What does OD&D say about multiple attacks for fighters?
When Paul, I will say that, friends, when Paul gave me the best gift ever, which was a hand custom bound version of original D&D, I made sure, and Paul included chainmail as the first thing in this volume. So fortunately, I always have all the rules together in one place. And as some of our viewers, I think, pointed out last time, there's this really cryptic place in the Monsters volume, volume two on page 5, that says, and so this is just the endless debate, where it says attack defense capabilities versus normal men are simply a matter of allowing one roll as a man type for every hit die. And then some other details that we're not going to. And then once again, Paul, it ends with combat is detailed in volume 3, also lie.
Also a lie. A lot of promises again, that these rules are going to show
again,
up later.
A lie.
Not so much.
We do know now that actually there was expanded combat information in the pre-publication draft, in the Gaiden draft of D&D. It got cut.
Interesting.
And this forward reference is unfortunately what we'd call a dangling pointer. But anyway, so there is this clause here where in the monster book, whatever your hit dice is, that is how many attacks you can get against, again, men type, which most of us interpret as one hit die or less, seems to be consistent. Was that intended for player characters of all types? Maybe. Was it, you know, was it intended for fighter types? Probably, based on the frequently asked questions, based on how it worked in chainmail, based on how it worked in AD&D, we can kind of use those tent poles to assume it was meant for fighters. It doesn't say here. You know, and some people actually do honor this for monsters and some people don't. It certainly doesn't exist in any other edition of D&D. Nobody else ever said that monsters should get that ability. So that's as close as you get in the actual original D&D books.
Interesting. Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know, that definitely that little section there in the monster book does seem to imply that the concept of sweep attack, right? I don't know.
Right.
Interesting. That's interesting. And
again, if you're referencing chainmail,
yeah,
you know, that is basically how it works for the hero types in chainmail. Your hero, okay, which is like a fourth level fighter in D&D, they take 4 hits to kill and they get to roll 4 dice in combat. The superhero, which is like 8th level, they get to roll 8 dice in combat. That's in chainmail. So assuming that you are honestly referring back to chainmail, you know, that is what it says there for the fighter types.
just gonna look at this text one more time here, right? So it says, capabilities versus normal men are simply a matter of allowing one roll as a man type for every hit die. Right? Does that imply, though, that it's not just fighters? I mean, thieves get that?
Oh, yeah.
Magic users get that?
Well,
cleric?
Yeah. Clearly, I mean, it clearly says it for monsters.
Yeah.
It's actually, what it is, you know, it is saying that for monsters.
What about, so in AD&D, it's a footnote to a chart about the number of attacks a fighter gets per level. Now, specifically, I'm going to point out that specifically, let me jump to this again. We're in page 25, I think. Yeah. It is fighters, paladins, and rangers attacks per melee round, which is such an interesting way of putting it, because the title of this chart is a little different in our second edition book, where it says warrior melee attacks per round. And the reason I want to point that out, right, is that the first edition AD&D book gave me some consternation and confusion about how does this work alongside rate of fire for missile weapons? Does this apply to missile weapons or not, right? This is per melee round, right? So that's like, I don't know, melee round is like a round of combat, right? I guess. Whereas second edition, I feel like clarifies that a little, and it says melee attacks per round. So clearly, melee only we're talking about for multiple weapons. I'm seventh level, and I get 3 attacks for every 2 rounds, which is super confusing, but basically the idea of like, I get 2 attacks one round, and then 1 attack the next round, and back and forth, and ping-ponging. And then eventually, by the time I hit like 13th level, I get 2 attacks every round. Any of that exist in OD&D, Dan?
No, that's a new rule that's new for AD&D. and which is a reason why it doesn't exist in Basic at all. And I think, uh-huh. Look, let me
wrong.
Yeah, go ahead. No?
What? Yeah.
What?
It is in BX. It is. I will refer to you to page
X. No, this is ridiculous.
It says,
what?
Fighters, as they reach higher levels, but the numbers are different. As they reach higher levels, fighters will be able to strike more than once per round. A suggested increase is that for every 5 levels above 15th, the fighter gains another attack that round. No more than 4 attacks per round may be gained. So not all the way up until 15th level do you get multiple attacks as a fighter in BX. I cannot say that I've ever played a BX game with 15th level fighters, but I find
now,
that one...
Great point. Now, I will point out that on that same page there, Paul, right, the last paragraph on that page says, it is important to note that these are only highlighted suggestions. Those players and DMs who wish to wait for the D&D companion supplement, which actually never got released in this series, will be provided with exact information concerning these higher levels. This information may not always agree with the suggestions presented here, and players may discover changes in their characters if they create their own rules of advancement. And Paul, I'm pretty sure that when the companion rules actually came out, that rule was not there.
Yeah, well, that's because the companion rules never came out. I love it. We have charts telling us to see sections where the rules just aren't there. We have references to books that were never published. Great. All good all around. Ultimately, though, I would say pointless, right? I as a player, whenever I played BX, whether it was as a young person when it first came out or more recently when I felt like I wanted to re-explore it, I can't say I ever gave a damn about 15th level plus. I never once played a game with that high level of a character. So, it didn't matter.
The game is D&D, if we think about it from, classic D&D from 50 years ago, D&D is not really structured to play, not structured, not tested for 15th level character play. Initially, the highest monster had 10 hit dice, basically. They had names for character levels up to about 9th to 10th. That's it. And Gary had an article in a strategic review early on that said, here's how many adventures I expect it's going to take you to get to 10th level and then to 15th level. But be aware, nobody exists in the entire world that's actually gotten to that level yet today. So this is entirely hypothetical. Nobody in my campaign, nobody in Dave Arneson's campaign has gotten to that level. So all of this stuff is entirely untested and not really supported. So I think many of us know that it's pretty shaky once you get to that point.
It's all of this reminds me of my computer science 201 course I took in college as I first dabbled into C++. In which our professor told us right off the bat, I'm about a chapter ahead of you guys. So do my best.
No.
I'm learning this as we go. Yeah.
No.
He was a pretty brilliant guy, actually, and he was able to teach us pretty well. But yeah, consistently just barely ahead of the curve. And frankly, that's the sense I get here from Gary, right? He's like, well, no one's gotten to this level yet, but it could happen. So I'm trying to prepare myself for when it does.
Yeah. Great point. And a lot of rules were like that at the time. Small little tangent. One of my players on Friday said, I just heard about this game from the 80s called Palladium, right? By Kevin Sambida, I think. And he's like, and so some people were telling me about it. And he says, and they were saying it wasn't very good. And I'm like, yeah, they're right. And, and it's like, why? And I haven't looked at it in 20 years or so. It's like, well, it seems like the rules are very stream of consciousness. There's a lot. There's like hundreds and hundreds of pages that seems like Mr. Sambida was just like, I'm just writing some stuff. And here's 1,000 spells. And here's a city with 500 buildings and shopkeepers in it, and I haven't tested or played with any of this, but it seems pretty good at the time. Probably, I think. It's a book. he shipped it. It's doing better than I am most days. But there's a lot. It, in the early days, yeah. there was a lot of, like, we're just writing some stuff. Maybe you're going to use it or not. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Figure it out. Yep. Okay. Brass tacks here. Sweep attacks. The answer seems to be existed in OD&D, possibly very widely for everyone, for all, not just fighters, but for every player character and every monster in the game. Crazy. Yeah, and in BX, doesn't exist at all. That's where we're landing. And I think,
Correct.
That both you and I are probably going to land in the same place of here. What's the right way to go? The answer is somewhere in the middle. Right? Like, give it to fighters. The end.
There you go. I can get on board with that. And I resisted that for a long time. Again, early on, you know, my longest running campaign in the 80s was using Moldvay BX. I love that set to death, actually. And so I was playing D&D without ever seeing the sweep attack rule for a long time. It wasn't in my DNA, and I actually played D&D without it up until just a couple of years ago. And the thing is, the thing that it makes a big difference is how many orcs does it take to challenge your party? And if the fighters are getting one attack per round in BX, that's a big difference than if they're getting eight attacks a round when they get to eighth level. You know, you run into an orc band in the wilderness, and you need to make it either, you know, eight times bigger or not based on that decision with the fighters, basically. And so for me, if I say that I'm using original D&D as my basis, the number of monsters for those types are scaled, expecting a Conan-like sweep attack output of attacks. And so in original D&D, you know, the number appearing for orcs is 30 to 300, and the number appearing for goblins is 40 to 400, comes out in the hundreds. When you switch to BX with a sweep attack rule, Moldvay very wisely, he observed this, he knew this was an issue, and at least in the dungeons, gave much smaller, right, much smaller numbers appearing. So if you look up orcs or goblins in BX, you know, the number appearing for orcs in the dungeon is, dot, 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 as I look it up, is 2 to 8. Yeah. Or in the wilderness, 10 to 60, right? Which is still not 30 to 300.
Yeah, they're not 30 to 300. So you're thinking that the balance here, so would you argue if I introduce sweep attacks into my BX game, I potentially have imbalanced things because I have smaller numbers of monsters? Yeah, interesting.
Yes. Yes.
You know, the funny thing is, me historically, right, as a kid, I was playing BX, plus I had the first edition AD&D Player's Handbook, which is where the sweep attack rule shows up in that footnote of that chart. But I can't say that I was ever aware of it as a kid, except for the presence, for me, of Pool of Radiance. It was the Pool of Radiance video game, which does implement that rule, that introduced me to the concept. And frankly, it's funny, right, that you have, basically, you need a computer simulation to prove the necessity of this rule, right? It's only by playing hundreds of battles with, you know, huge, and that's definitely in Pool of Radiance. Pool of Radiance, you just get huge swarms of orcs and kobolds and such, and, like, having a fighter or two with sweep attacks is huge in those combats. Absolutely huge.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'll point out that's where we get the terminology from. So what Paul and I call sweep attack, because as we've seen, that word isn't in OD&D and the rule doesn't exist in basic, and the word it's not, it's got a weird phrasing in AD&D. We now call it sweep attack for short, and it comes directly from Pool of Radiance. Yep. So at least we have a word for it now.
Just to round this out, Dan, what about multiple attacks with ranged weapons? Where do we see that? Because I'm starting to think that the answer is I think that the answer might be only AD&D. I don't think that's in OD&D or BX as I'm paging through it, right? And
definitely not only BX, exists, right? Okay, let's definitely not BX. I think you're right.
And I think it's another one of those odd rules that shows up in a chart, right? I only know its existence because when I look at the chart of weapons in AD&D First Edition, I see there's a column called rate of fire, which tells me that that's how many times I get to fire. And sure enough, with your longbow or your short bow, the rate of fire is 2.
I'm pretty sure that's right. I'll also say that I feel that's a place where, because you can kind of interpret where some of this stuff came from, like the AD&D, like, you know, beginning to give extra attacks to fighters even outside the sweep attack. I feel like someone said there's this radical cliff-like drop-off between, you know, one hit die and two hit die about whether your fighter gets 8 attacks or just 1. And so sort of to make that a little bit more gradual, you might, here's a rule that sort of gives you some extra attacks in other cases to make that not quite so dramatic a shift. And I think with the ranged attacks in AD&D, again, Gary was sticking real hard to the idea, and I just don't think this is viable, but Gary was sticking real hard to when they originally wrote a combat round is 1 minute. And somebody probably came in and said, you can shoot way more arrows in 1 minute than just one. Yeah. And he probably came in and said, okay, well, I'm going to make you happy. Here's like, you can shoot 2 arrows or 3 arrows or something like that per round. And that's sort of weirdly,
you can shoot 2 arrows, but you can throw 3 darts.
There you go. That's it. Which again is super important to pull a radiance because your magic users can use the darts and they can chuck out an enormous amount of missile combat, which again, doesn't seem in flavor to me, but that's important if you see that rule.
And it's a little confusing in that video game because it kind of gets the presentation, it doesn't really show all the rules, right? So you're like, what's going on? Why do I keep running out of darts, Dan? What's happening? And it's because it kind of like is doing the multiple attacks under the covers without really showing them to you, which sucks.
Good point.
But also another case of like, I wasn't really super aware of that rule. I think I was a little more aware of that rule when I was playing BX plus the player's handbook, because it's right there. Rate of fire, 2. I get to shoot 2 arrows. I remember my friends when I was young, like they would always, oh, I gotta have a bow because 2 arrows is fantastic. And I remember seeing you reiterate that when you were starting to play Pool of Radiance. I think maybe, were you aware of that prior to getting in and playing the game? You're like, oh, 2 shots per round, gotta have my bows.
Yeah, I played enough AD&D that I knew if this is first edition rules, I knew that was going to be important. And I think when I started, I had the equipment list next to me, and I'd even like computed some average damage output. You know, let's talk a little bit more about equipment. But before we do, just on that one particular issue, Paul, do you like that? Like in your D&D play, do you prefer ranged weapons that I'll just shoot once, or do you prefer this maybe 2 or 3 times?
I actually prefer it just once. And honestly, I like that. And this is a house rule that both you and I use now that's got no basis in any of these rules, which is I like multiple attacks getting pushed down into fighter feats. I like it being a customization of fighter. Ooh, now I get 2, right? Now I can shoot twice or I can attack twice per round all the time. I think that's great
That's worked quite nicely for games.
I can't say that I've run the game much with sweep attack. I think I would have to like remind myself to like, oh, that's right, don't forget sweep attack. Let that happen.
I think many DMs say that.
And I've also rarely run games where the players are out in the wilderness and I'm rolling my 30 to 300 orcs. Honestly, the only time I can think of that really coming up is when you've run outdoor spoliation. Generally that's not an encounter I run, and by the time the characters are like, you know, 4th or 5th level where it matters, I'm usually not throwing goblins at them, right? Or orcs. I'm throwing something harder, right? You're throwing something harder at them by that point.
So I will say this, and you know, our viewers can go back to the prior episode where we had a whole hour just about sweep attacks a year or two ago. And I will say that for me, the thing that brought me around is that if I am interested in doing D&D type wargaming, like with Book of War, like we've had our couple seasons of so far, for the fighters to be viable on the battlefield, they need to have 10 times as many attacks as any normal creature. And then they can statistically appear basically. So basically just that, if I'm interested in doing wargaming and having the high level fighters be useful at, in any way, shape, or at all, they got to have sweep attacks. And that's actually what kind of convinced me to embrace it, to keep it in my D&D game, to use the original D&D rules from 50 years ago, and to maintain the high numbers of monsters. And for me, that's part of the D&D experience, and that's why I have it in my game now.
Now, as I'm recollecting, my chief exposure for me is the game Pool of Radiance. And Pool of Radiance, I don't think you can sweep orcs. We keep mentioning orcs, but I don't think you can, because I think they're 1+1
Correct.
One or something like that. Right?
Correct. That footnote that you looked at, Paul, again, very tiny, the tiniest change imaginable makes a big difference there, because in original D&D, it didn't say one die, less than one die. It effectively said one die or less, basically.
Yeah, no, this very
and
specifically
so
says less than one.
If you look at the fact,
yes, you weren't getting it against your. You also weren't getting against skeletons, or right. I don't think there's any undead you got it against in that game.
Let's table that.
The point I'm making,
as our viewer Ash said last time, is that there's a D&D fact that Gary wrote, and the example is a fighter getting multiple attacks against orcs. Right. That's in the example of fourth level of fighter against some orcs. They get four attacks. Right, which indicates one die or less. You go to AD&D, and it says less than one die, and orcs, of course, canonically have exactly one hit die, and now they don't count. That's a huge difference, right? But the thing is, in OD&D, orcs come in numbers of hundreds, which indicates that in order to fight them, you've got to have sweep attacks have to be viable for them. And in fact, to my understanding, that actually was Dave Arneson's criteria. You get sweep attacks specifically against monsters that show up in hundreds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I could certainly see the argument for using sweep attacks, and I could use them. But again, I knowing myself, I feel like I'm probably going to forget, because the rarity of it actually happening in any of my games is very low.
It's legitimate. It's not a slam dunk. I resisted it for many years. They're like in a dungeon now, there's an issue of like, can you fit enough monsters into a room for them to be a threat against high level fighters? That becomes an issue. So it's not a slam dunk. But I think for original D&D, with the way the monsters are presented, and if you're going to be doing high level wargaming stuff, I think it's a fundamental part of how the game's structured.
All right, Dan, we're more than halfway through the show. We should probably move on.
Let's just talk a little bit more about equipment, right? So you're talking some interesting things about how bows work with multiple attacks. In original D&D, in the supplement, now I will point out, right, so original D&D comes into existence with this big list of weapons, right? You got sword, spear, mace, flail, two-handed sword, pike, halberd, dagger, on and on and on and on. Mace, right? And in original D&D, on publication, there is no distinction between any of these, right? There's no descriptions of these things. There's no rules for how they work differently. Absolutely nothing. And again, this is a place whereby if you're going to have any distinction in these things, if it makes a difference why you buy one weapon versus another, you have to go back to chainmail. And the weapon list in D&D is exactly the same weapon list in the exact same order that you see it in chainmail. So it would make sense that for these things to make a difference, you'd have to be using the chainmail man-to-man rules. You'd have to be using the tables there for every weapon has a different effect against different target armor. Paul, I think in the past you've said that you would have preferred to have a narrower list of weapons.
I do like a narrow list of weapons. I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always found this page of BX very evocative. And first of all, I love that illustration. And then the list is pretty short. Let's be honest. It's a pretty short list. There's not a ton of stuff. And it's, I'm pretty happy with it.
Yep. This is a place where Paul and I slightly don't think the same. I like the larger list, and in our OED house rules, I like having some kind of crisp reason why each weapon's at least a little different than anyone else. And there's about a dozen of them there. And I kind of like having just a little bit more flavor about what the medieval technology available is like. So I'm someone that actually does like just a little bit more grit than saying, you know, your weapon's either small or large, end of story. I know some people like to simplify it all the way down that way, but.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, if you look at 10 Dead Rats, that's exactly what I did. 10 Dead Rats is OD&D based, but it does boil it down to just hand weapon, which is a Warhammerism, but a Warhammerism I always enjoyed. Like, what's the difference between a club and a mace and an axe and a one-handed sword? Nothing. No.
Yeah.
I don't mind that at all.
Now, with the first supplement to Original D&D that came out a couple months afterwards, again, they came in and kind of gave some extra detail, some extra filling out some of the things that they were missing in the original publication. They did give variable weapon damage to all these different weapons. Like, if you're looking at BX, it's on page B27, and where some weapons do D4, some weapons do D6 or D8 or D10. Do you use that when you, if you say you're running BX, do you use that?
I do. In fact, we mentioned this in the last episode that I have corrected BX equipment list that I use, which is available on my blog, partly just because of how it's spread out in this book it is, right? The lovely page that I was showing before that I love is of course only shows the costs. And then if you want to get to variable weapon, well, that's an optional rule on page B27. And if you want to look up the encumbrance, that's yet another chart. There's a lot of page flipping to find all the details about items. But I do use the variable weapon damage. You know, if I was going to write my own rules, like 10 Dead Rats, which I totally did, I would prefer the variable weapon damage to be based more on size category, right? A one-handed weapon does this much damage, two-handed weapon does that much damage at the end. I don't have to worry about why would I choose a two-handed sword versus a pole arm. That's a level of complexity I generally don't want to deal with. But I feel like it's pretty ingrained in D&D players that different weapons have different damage types. And so, I don't know, feels correct, nostalgic, I don't know, whatever to me. So I do use it.
Well, let me ask this. So when the variable damage type came up in the first supplement to OD&D, right, it was, and it's on this page here, it was a little bit more sophisticated. You have all your weapon types here, and notice that there's two different columns for the damage that each one might do. And one of the columns here is man-sized or smaller for your target, right? And the other column is larger than man-sized. And so you have different possible dice of damage depending on whether you've got a small target, a man-sized target, or a larger target. More or less, this came through into AD&D as shown. Basically, what Moldvay did is he took this same table and just snipped out the last column. Right, so all these numbers that you see here are exactly the same as what you see in Moldvay BX, and he just snipped out the large target size distinction. So what I might ask to you, Paul, and our viewers is, what do you like better? Do you like the distinction with the large targets for each weapon, or do you like snipping that out like Moldvay did for just
Again,
one damage?
I don't know.
Per weapon
maybe I'm in the minority here, but no, I don't. I don't want variable. I don't want to have to deal with weapon type. I don't want to have to deal with is my target large or small. I don't want to deal with the fact that my weapon sometimes does this much damage and sometimes that much damage. I just want a number, a die type, the end.
This is a place where I agree. Right. So I think this is one of these very wise editorial distinctions. I think that this is a great example of a really wise choice that Moldvay made of I don't want to see that either. It's going to be a tiny amount of difference anyway, frankly, in most cases. But that's something that to keep the pace of the game, you know, for new players, it's already hard enough just to like find which die you're supposed to roll. never mind, is this small or large, and look that up. As DM, I can't memorize. I can't memorize the two columns of data, frankly. So I think this is a good choice. I agree not having the distinction. And it's something that wasn't sticky, right? Once you get to third edition, every weapon just has one die type. So it wasn't a rule that was really viable long term. So this one I'll give them away.
Am I misremembering? Don't you do something in your OD&D games where like axes and clubs and swords are different based on maybe what armor they're facing or something like that?
Am I misremembering that? You get a hit bonus, right? So for example, mace against plate mail, you get +4 to hit.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's even a level of detail that is too much for it. Like again, if I'm trying to figure out how much damage or what the stats are of my weapon, and I don't want to have to cross-reference the enemy pretty much ever. I don't want to have to be looking up on a chart or remembering, you know, so I don't use that either. Now that's a flavor, right, of that comes from, is that first edition or does that come from OD&D?
That's okay. So I have a blog article about how they try to do this and completely gummed it up mathematically. But again, if it basically comes from chainmail, right? Every weapon has different chances to hit against different armors. And basically, like for example, a mace, you have the exact same chance of hitting someone in plate mail as you do that someone that's unarmored. So basically what I'm doing in OED more or less reflects that of, you know, because of that bonus, your chance to hit someone in plate mail is the same as if they're unarmored. So the mace basically takes away the armor bonus. And I know that some of our great viewers have been discussing on our Discord server lately about whether that's actually historical realistic or not. But that's why there's a list of 12 weapons. They all have a different profile against different armors as of chainmail. They tried to bring it forward into OD&D and AD&D and screwed up the math, but the idea is sort of there.
There's a couple. So we could get into, and I don't want to get into here, but like one of the things that I've always kind of wanted and never seen from the weapon list is having seeing some level of balance too with the non-human fighter types, right? Dwarf and halfling, I'm thinking of specifically, both happen to be small enough that they're listed as not being allowed to use large weapons. I would love that to be a gate into different damage types. It isn't quite it. The sword kind of screws that all up. And then you get into the whole question of, is the battle axe two-handed or not? But we had this whole discussion in the last episode, so I'm not here to rehash that. One thing I will point out, though, that is that because I'm used to using this VX list of weapons, there are a couple of weapons that I am not accustomed to having in the game that I believe you are.
Right.
And I'm specifically going to call out the staff and variations on the crossbow. Right. So,
also,
and
I halberd? Find
this is a. Right? Yeah, halberd is a polearm, in my opinion. No.
Got it.
Yep. VX just has a polearm. Polearm, the end. Don't worry about it. It's a polearm. Right. I would say most the one equipment thing that comes up most for me when running BX for folks that are surprised by is the no staff thing. I'm a wizard. Can I have a staff? No.
Yeah.
And I have darts? Yeah. Don't exist. What can I have? A dagger. The end. End of story. Yep. That's what you get. No other weapon.
Yep,
that's what I'm used to. And I'm used to crossbows being big, heavy, two-handed things. There's no such thing as a cute, light little crossbow.
I was looking up a thing in the... I hear that. I almost think it's too bad that original D&D didn't explicate that magic users could use staffs in the class text. They added it later in AD&D. I think it's something that's kind of obvious flavor-wise would be nice.
Yeah.
I actually am not super fond of my magic users always throwing daggers all the time. Arguably, if you look in OD&D, if you look again, this is one of these places where if you look in some completely unexpected footnote place, right? If you look at the magic staffs, magic users can use magic staffs to attack with like a staff of striking. That's actually permitted.
Which
So, okay.
All right, let's get this. Here we go. I'm okay with that because here we go. Like, okay, so why do we think magic users should be able to use staffs, right? Well, there's something traditional about it, right? When you think of every representation you've seen of Gandalf, he's carrying a staff, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this often then gets put into the rules as quarterstaff, and then immediately our imagination goes to, well, the classic scene with Robin Hood, right? Robin Hood fighting Friar Tuck over the river, and we're fighting with quarterstaffs. And that's a pretty different thing, in my opinion. That's a...
Okay.
You ever see Gandalf twirling the quarterstaff around and, like, you know, wielding it, like, in this kind of... Like, no. I think the answer is no.
I think he did in Lord of the... I think in the movies, I think Jackson
in the movies,
have him doing that a couple
in the
times,
movies,
right?
You're right. But how often in the book does he swing... Does he bop someone on the head with his staff? I think more often the staff is an implement of magical power. So therefore, I do like it appearing only as a magic item. It is a magical staff. Okay, well, now it's a thing. But generally, right, you've got, like, you know, you've got Gandalf sneaking into, was it Theoden's court by saying, like, you wouldn't deny an old man his walking stick, right? Because it's not a weapon. It's a stick. It's a walking stick.
Okay.
And it has magical power. And I like that reverse. Like, oh, I thought it was a common, ordinary item, but no, it has magical powers and it can do damage and blah, blah, blah. That's exciting. But if Gandalf was walking in with, like, a, you know, and those staves, I think the claim often with, like, the kind of, you know, Robin Hood fighting on the river with the quarterstaves, right? The claim was that those things were, like, shod at the end, weren't they? They had, like, metal. They were metal tipped. Like, these were clearly weapons as opposed to Gandalf's walking stick. So anyway, that's my rant for today. I like staves as being a normal item, right? Just a stick that happens to be imbued with magical power.
Argument I hadn't come up with myself. Solid.
Yeah.
I like it. Okay.
I'm fiery today. I don't know.
Good. So good. I like that. No, I like that.
Yeah, I like that. I like that, you know, I think the other point of contention that comes up from BX is like, and we talked a little bit about this last week, but what are thieves allowed to use, Dan? What the heck weapon? Can a thief fire a crossbow? Can a thief have a longbow? Can a thief have a own sword?
I have a whole blog article about that because that is wildly different in different editions. It's wildly different. Yeah. I think we touched on that a little bit last time, you know, but just... huge difference between these two editions we're focused on here. In original D&D, they could use a sword and a dagger. That's it. The end. No ranged weapons whatsoever. End of story. In BX, they can use any weapon in the list. Period. End of story. And other editions fall in a whole bunch of different other locations. But that you can't get more stark than that. I think somewhere in the middle is better.
It definitely brings up, unfortunately, head scratcher questions of, well, what about the backstab ability? Right? Can I backstab someone with a crossbow? Right? Right? And later editions, of course, blur this line. Right? And by fifth edition, it's not even backstab anymore. It's called sneak attack. And the answer is hell yeah, you can use a crossbow for it. Absolutely. where do we land on that in our games?
Well, I think you and I might be a little different. So what I have in OED, you're always surprised by when people look it up. And that is that I've got thieves that can use basically small stuff. So they can use a dagger, a spear, a hand axe, a mace, because they're all small. And then for ranged weapons, they can use swords. And they can use slings and light crossbows. And in OED, I don't give them self bows. I don't give them longbows. You know, there's some reasons for that. The thieves with slings are, you know, very core to the thieves in Favre in Lankmar, right? They're all skilled with slings. You can hide them easily in town. Thieves are sort of an urban class in that early understanding. You know, and for me, I'm thinking light crossbows. The whole point to a crossbow is that you can basically be untrained, you know, cock it and shoot it reasonably. But bows take years and years of training to be good at them. So that's why I did that in OED. Not everybody likes that. It's a hard show. Okay. All right. Great.
No, I mean, I'm trying to find the actual backstab rule in BX here as you're talking, and frankly, I'm struggling to find it. Where the hell is it?
It's probably in a footnote.
Probably.
I feel it's probably in a footnote to some table. Okay, B10, it's the first line for their special abilities. It says, when striking unnoticed from behind, a thief gains a +4 on 2-hit rolls and inflicts twice the normal amount of damage.
You know, my pedantic answer to, you know, what can a thief backstab with is I like to dig into that word backstab. Do you stab someone? Are you stabbing them? Do you stab someone with a crossbow? No, you do not. therefore you cannot backstab.
I get it. That's good. I get it. No. But I gotta ask one other thing about the equipment list. Yeah. I gotta ask one other thing about the equipment list. Okay. This is my last pointed thing. Here's a notable difference between the OD&D equipment list and the BX equipment list. Helmet. Original D&D has helmet as an item that you can buy, and in Moldvay BX, that is gone. That is not there. And obviously, the interpretation is that, the armor you buy, whatever it is, it just includes a helmet, and obviously, we're not going to track that. I kind of like an original D&D tracking the helmet as an important thing. Now, obviously, again, original D&D didn't give any rule for it, which is the only problem for that. I've seen Mike Mornard, who's one of the earliest players, get asked what good is a helmet in original D&D, and his response is, it protects your head, stupid. was the earliest possible response for what a helmet's for. I have a rule, you know, there's a rule that was added in AD&D that was frankly complicated, frankly, and I'm not thrilled about. What I currently have in OED is that it wipes out half the criticals against you. If you're wearing a helmet, that's what I currently have. Seems clean enough for me. I kind of like it. Do you like original D&D with the helmet as a separate item, or do you prefer BX without it?
I prefer without it, frankly. I just assume helmet is part of armor. If you're wearing leather chain or plate mail armor, one of the pieces is a helmet. Just jump to that assumption. I feel like there's already enough fiddliness here with the shield, but I like this, that the shield exists as a separate thing because it does consumes one of your hands, right? So therefore, it's definitely changing what you can do because you've dedicated one of your hands to using a shield. Whereas the helmet, like, well, why wouldn't you get a helmet? I don't know, right? Like, there's, you know, and so generally, I just assume it's basically part of the equipment, part of the armor. If you're wearing armor, I assume you're wearing a helmet. And then, you know, I don't deduct any losses. I don't make the armor less effective if you lose your helmet, just as I wouldn't do that if you lost a single piece of, like, your shin guard or whatever.
I think the counter argument is that you know, is your head's very important. Paul, don't lose your head. And if someone, like, if you look at Greek hoplites or something, like, if you had to pick one single item of armor and you couldn't have anything else, the first thing that you'd pick is a helmet, right? You'd pick helmet and shield beyond anything else. So I think that you know, trained fighters would be, you know, if someone forced them to choose, I'll lose a greave, I'll lose two greaves, I'll lose the breastplate, but the helmet's the most important thing. So I do kind of like having that on the sheet separately. I think of a whole lot of fiction where it's really important of, like, you take a break and your helmet's off. You need to listen at a door. The helmet's off. Is your helmet on? Is it off? Has it been replaced by a magical helmet? And I actually kind of like that being in the mind of us players at the table. If the helmet gets lost or broken, you're way more vulnerable than if anything else got lost. I actually like having the helmet be tracked.
Here's my counter argument is this, that I don't like when we start breaking apart the pieces of armor. And I already feel like there's an abstraction by just saying leather, chain, played, right? Because even if you look, say, look at Warhammer Fantasy RPG. Warhammer Fantasy RPG absolutely breaks it apart into pieces, right? You have you usually have a chest piece and a leg piece and a head piece is basically breaks it into that kind of. And Warhammer also includes hit locations, so it's actually important, like which part, where did I hit you? Like we determine that, and do you have armor there, and how much, and blah blah blah. And it just gets very fiddly. And I personally think it doesn't really work super well with the different historic kinds of armor, because not a lot of people, when they were wearing chainmail, were wearing pants. Like, chain pants is unusual. The hauberk is, you know, it includes a skirt, right? And it goes basically down to your knees, and then where it's slit depends on whether you're a footman or a horseman. But it's kind of protecting your legs, pretty much. So I already just kind of assume, I'm not going to get into pieces of armor. I'm not going to deal with, like, oh, you lost this chunk or that chunk or what have you, right? And then especially you get into plate, and it's just like there's a million pieces. But later editions of D&D do this, right? And you end up with stuff like, oh, I have a breastplate, and that's different from full plate, right? And, it's too fiddly for me. I don't want it. I love the simplicity of there are three kinds of armor, and I have absolutely memorized what their armor classes are, the end. It's very easy. And I like the uniformity of that. Every piece of armor jumps the armor class by 2 points. So then you have the shield to sub in the extra missing elements in the progression, and we have a combo for every armor class. Done and done.
I hear that. That's attractive.
Dan, we have run the clock, I'm realizing. I'm doing a poor job as timekeeper. Usually it's my job to call in, rein it in. And we're over, Dan. We gotta wrap this thing up. Any final thoughts about VX versus OD&D, specifically combat? And I can't even say combat. We didn't even get to the combat turn. That was, we were queued up to talk about.
Right, we didn't.
The turn sequence. we're never gonna finish this topic.
Paul, we're both coming in hot from slightly different directions. It's an irresistible force and an immovable object. This is what you get.
Final thoughts on a couple of other random bits and bobs that we talked about today.
I'm glad you asked, Paul, because yes, I do have final thoughts. And this is a place, viewers, where Paul and I have slightly different opinions. If we talk about the equipment choices that you equip your character before they go into combat, I do like a little bit more detail. I like an opportunity to think about what are these different medieval weapons? Why would different people choose them or use them in circumstances? And I do like a little bit of concrete detail about specifically the helmet and is your noggin vulnerable right now or not? So I don't want to go further than that. I don't know, maybe I'm biased. Maybe I am nostalgic that this particular edition got in my head. But I feel good about this set of options. I like a little bit more detail, and I know that Paul likes it even simpler than I do. So for me, original D&D has about the right level of detail, and Moldvay got a little bit too abstract for my taste on that one.
Yeah, I very much prefer the abstraction of BX, to the point of that is like the number one handout that I have. If I'm running an old school game, I'm handing out player character record sheets that look like they came straight out of the BX book, and I'm handing my special equipment chart that I wrote up that tries to gather all the bits together into one place and make it a little more digestible. It's a single page. Here's all the equipment. Go. And I like that. Yeah. So yeah, this is a case where just Dan and I, our preferences don't quite match up. But I would say, all in all, I don't know that it affects the gameplay hugely. I think players who play in a game of Dan's and a game of mine will be like, yeah, pretty close. Pretty simple.
You know, my weapon modifiers basically only make a difference when you're fighting other human types that are in a particular armor. Mm. So against like standard fantasy monsters, probably won't see any difference, honestly.
There you go. Yeah, sweep attacks maybe are not going to come up unless you happen to be playing as a fourth level fighter against goblins for some reason, which tends not to happen in my case. Viewers, I'm going to call it to you. What did we miss? What must go into part three of this debate? Let us know. Quick preview. My prognostication says that next week we're probably not going to do part three, so it might be a little bit before part three happens. If there's a specific element of OD&D versus BX that we have not yet covered, you would love to see in part three, please leave a comment in the comment section of the video here for us to look at, and we'll hopefully get to that soon.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We're on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and GitHub and places like that. We do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of the sites. So please look for us there and shatter that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are hosted at our website at wanderingdms.com. Also, you can find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us right now on one of those sites, and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And as always, huge thanks to our patrons here who support the show, help us run the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server with a conversation about new D&D and old D&D and horror games and miniature making and science fiction just continues around the clock 24/7. We would love to see you there. We'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue this conversation in our live video after chat. And if you aren't a patron already, just go over there, throw into the $1 tier, and we would love for you to join us, one of our favorite parts of the week every week. We're live every Sunday that we can make it at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we have plans specifically for what we're going to do next Sunday, and we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.